Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Before we go any further, I just want to comment on a couple of things from the public health officer's report on Tuesday, one of which is all of the local healthcare entities, all of the safety net clinics, plus the Dignity, Kaiser, and PAM for all tooling up for those pediatric vaccinations, which we're all anticipating from 5 to 11 years old, is going to be approved very, very soon. And an approval that did come down today, in case you didn't get it, was Moderna boosters and Johnson & Johnson boosters. So approval to mix and match after a study came out a few weeks ago showing a quite remarkable improvement when people who had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine got a second shot with Moderna, much, much higher levels of antibody. Makes sense. You know, we use this thing called triangulation to get a fix on a location. Well, you can imagine that the different vaccines are allowing the immune system to kind of triangulate on the COVID virus. I shared with you a study, well, it's been about a month ago that I shared this one, where people who had been infected with the first SARS infection, SARS-1, this was in Singapore, and they had their Pfizer vaccine and their antibody levels were amazing. But more importantly, because they already had an immune system that recognized SARS-1 and they got a look at SARS-2, their immune systems were able to triangulate on all of the variations of SARS that we have in the lab to check them against. So it wouldn't surprise me, and it would be really interesting to see whether vaccinating someone with the old SARS-1 vaccine might provide a similar triangulation on the COVID virus. So more to come, no doubt, on this topic. We're going to drop this topic and move to something I think that's very significant. And this is our current issue with narcotics and narcotic prescriptions and opiates in this country, and the enormous about-face and backlash that's currently going on. And it's back to the past. It's now we're back in the late 70s and early 80s in terms of the fear that physicians have to prescribe opiates. And we're not talking about just to addicts here, although we do have some problems being generated by, would you believe, AI algorithms and unintended consequences? I bet you would. First of all, let's go back in the Wayback Machine to 1890, where I was able to find data that there were 4.5 million opiate addicts identified in the United States. So that's about roughly half a percentage point. Now, in 2017, that figure was about 3 million Americans identified having current or past opiate use disorder, which is the new code for inappropriate use of these medications. So that's about 3 per 100 or 3%. I want to just do a little personal anecdote, and then we're going to move to a story that I read in Wired magazine this last month, which is what got me on this topic, and I'll be crediting the author of that in a moment. But in the 1970s, I was in college, and the second half of the 1970s, I was actually doing research into the endorphins. In the 1970s, many canards appeared in the medical literature to discourage prescribing opiates, to discourage literally physicians prescribing opiates to anybody, including such nonsense as several papers purporting to show that the use of opiates increased the growth rate of breast cancer. This widely quoted article was used as an excuse to deny narcotics to terminally ill patients. Now, you have to ask yourself, if they're dying, why are we worried about addiction? But the answer was, well, let's be worried about making them die faster. And I have to tell you, if you scare a doctor by implicitly threatening to sue them blame them, or pull their medical license, you will change that doctor's behavior. It's reliable. Most doctors fear losing their license way more than they fear causing needless suffering. Sad to say, but true. So it was very hard to prescribe opiates in the late 70s and early 80s. And many people suffered unnecessarily, particularly people with terminal diseases, but also people with chronic pain, particularly people who had, quote unquote, failed back and failed neck surgery, of which there had been a whole lot in the 70s and early 80s because those were supposed to fix that chronic pain. And sometimes they worked. Things improved in the late 1980s, and it became more rational for a while. And that's when I graduated and started practicing. But in the mid-90s, and this is coincidentally or maybe not so coincidentally, OxyContin came out in 1996, and Purdue Pharma, I think, began heavily lobbying doctors. We've all heard about that story. But I suspect there was a fair amount of political contributions going on behind the scenes as well, because in the late 1990s, the state of California, among many other states, mandated pain education for doctors. And we began to hear that we should be treating pain, that pain was the fifth vital sign. And the message to doctors and institutions was that they could be sued for not prescribing narcotics to treat severe pain. So a complete about face. And from the late 1990s to 2010, as you might expect, opioid prescriptions quadrupled, and opioid overdose deaths also quadrupled. So let's think about opioids in general. If we go back to that ancient history when we had half a percentage point of opiate addicts, doctors were not in any way controlled in their prescribing of opiates. And in fact, opiates were not controlled at all. You could buy them in what now we often call snake oil or potions, basically undisclosed amounts of narcotics, formulas given for helping your baby sleep that actually contained opium or laudanum. There were also quite a bit of questions about the use of marijuana, and that continued to increase. 1906 was the first legislation, and that was where certain things had to be labeled with accuracy, or you could pull them. That was all. Just make sure people knew what the dose was. And that decreased the sale of patent medicines about 33% once it was clear that you were giving your baby. But a whole lot of people had drug issues by about 1911. And in 1914, the Harrison Narcotic Act was passed. And this is really interesting because it was supposed to regulate the production and distribution of opiate substances. And it came out under the Commerce Clause. So it was purely a business thing designed for public safety. Later, it got re-weaponized by law enforcement officers for the purposes of prosecuting doctors who prescribed opiates to addicts. During this time, alcohol was the big focus. And so we have prohibition that happened in 1919. California, by the way, made marijuana illegal a little earlier than that. 1913 was outlawed. So we have a long and checkered history of going after these things and lumping them together as if they were one drug. In 1937, the National Marijuana Tax Act was presented. This was lovely. This was worthy of our current political setup here, because what they did was it was a tax and stamp act. And I've actually seen one of these tax stamps. One of my patient's father was a doctor and he showed it to me. And it's basically you had to pay for a tax stamp, and then you had pretty onerous regulations in terms of a detailed account of your transactions, inspections, affidavits, private information regarding the people who purchased marijuana from you. And the whole idea was to basically make it so difficult to sell marijuana that a lot of people would get out of the business. And indeed, it appears to have had its effect. the idea that marijuana was the focus and that caused insanity, criminality, or death is, to me, amusing. Yeah, I saw Reefer Madness too, but when you think of it in the context of where we are now and the fact that doctors are being scared out of prescribing opiates, and in fact, doctors who work for large medical systems, by the way, more than half of primary care doctors are now employees, and they have employers who have decided that they should not be prescribing narcotics at all, ever, because it's too much hassle and because the regulatory change is in the wind. But my point is, it's a flip to the left, flip to the right, and it hasn't worked, okay? So between 2010 and 2020, we had a 60% drop in opiate prescriptions. So that was effective, except that the overdose rate doubled. And that's simply because of the fentanyl. We all know about that problem, but only 0.5% of the people who have taken medical opioids actually develop opioid use disorder. Now, the bureaucracies are very worried about these opioid deaths. And since they can't control the fentanyl, they're doubling down on controlling the opioid prescriptions. And this is backfiring majorly because of the use of AI. Over the past two decades, the U.S. Department of Justice has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into developing and maintaining state-level prescription drug databases. These are supposed to track scripts for certain controlled substances, all opiates, the benzodiazepines, that's your Valium class of drugs. And basically, the government can see the pharmaceutical market. And by the way, this is the last two decades. Where were they before 2011? Just asking. Apparently not looking. Maybe they were accepting suggestions not to look. But over the last few years, something really bad has happened, which is that a single company called Appriss has come to dominate the United States market. And they've developed an opiate AI that looks at people's prescriptions, looks at other factors, and it's an analytic tool basically preventing overdose, but it's also preventing pain management because that wasn't how they programmed it. They asked the AI to lower the risk of overdose. I'm about to give you an anecdote. It's called Narcs Care. At its most basic level, we have one in the state of California as well, but the doctor queries the medical history of a patient using their standard identifiers, name, birth date, address, etc. And they look for red flags. One of this is doctor shopping behavior. It notes the number of pharmacies a patient has visited, the distance they travel to receive health care, and the combinations of prescriptions they receive. It's supposed to produce a unique score, kind of like a credit score. They roll a lot of stuff in here that is really scary to me. Medical claims data from the insurance, electronic health records, emergency medical system data, and criminal justice data. And this is now being used in monitoring in at least 8 states, including Florida and Texas. People get a 3-digit number that's supposed to sum up their risk for overdose. Appriss software is used to manage prescription drug monitoring all over the country now. Not just those states, it's actually been incorporated in things like the CURE system that we use here in California. In the case of Catherine, a woman who was a graduate student in psychology with endometriosis, she was hospitalized in severe pain. The doctors weren't sure if she'd had a ruptured cyst. She was clearly in pain. She received IV antibiotics until day 4, when she wasn't getting any better, and somebody checked her in the system, and they literally kicked her out of the hospital because she had such a high score. Now, the question that Catherine had was, she wasn't a regular user of narcotics. Why had she been flagged with a high score? She only saw a couple of physicians. She did have a prescription for a benzodiazepine, so maybe that was a factor. But what she had was she had sick pets. She had two old golden retrievers. They were older dogs. They had multiple medical problems. One of them had epilepsy, had had surgery. They both were on opioids, benzodiazepines, and sometimes even barbiturates. But prescriptions for animals are put under their owner's name. That's a problem if you have sick pets, because their drugs are your drugs as far as the AI is concerned. It turns out that 20% of people who are most likely to be flagged have cancer because they're seeing multiple doctors, multiple specialists, and that triggers the AI. It's like living in the wrong zip code and going after car insurance with a perfect record. The other thing about this algorithm, it looks at the medical records for diagnosis of depression and PTSD, because these are, quote, variables that could impact risk assessment. In other words, increase your risk of an overdose. What does that mean? Does that mean I shouldn't code depression or PTSD on a patient ever, even if it's true, so that they can still get narcotics? Well, maybe so. Also, there have been several studies looking at how the use of these records have a disproportionate impact on women who are more likely to suffer trauma from abuse. And also, because criminal justice data is in there, and we know that the criminal justice system is skewed against racial minorities, such individuals, persons of color, are more likely to have a high score, regardless of the actual risk. And none of these algorithms have actually been tested. They've never been validated as safe and effective. It's really crazy. Let's talk a little bit about one of the embedded injustices for women. And this goes all the way back to the original work, because this algorithm is based on something called the opioid risk tool that was published in 2005 by a doctor named Lynn Webster, who was the former president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine, so knows something about it. So Webster went through all the studies trying to identify the risk factors and looked at personal history, family history. He scored a lot of things. If you had schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, history of major depression. So he created a questionnaire. That was the opioid risk tool. But it contains some implicit bias, let's put it that way. So he found a study showing that a history of sexual abuse in girls tripled their rate of addiction. So he included the question whether patients had experienced sexual abuse and codified it as a risk factor, but he didn't ask it for boys, only for women, only for girls. Why? Because there was not a published study on boys. So there's huge gender bias embedded in this algorithm. And now, with doctors being threatened with the loss of their license or the loss of their job for prescribing opioids, we now have a situation where people are being forced onto very rapid, quote unquote, tapering schedules. And we'll talk about that in a moment. These algorithms are a colossal fail. You know, you could say, well, they're a colossal success because they help avoid overdose. But if you want to help avoid overdose by taking drugs away from people who need them, you're going to end up with other unintended consequences. Because AIs and these algorithms obscure the sources of the decision making, there's no way to validate it, really. And it hasn't been validated against actual statistics showing that in states, for example, where this is used, that you actually get fewer overdoses. And you probably don't, because what you do when you don't give people opioids and they have pain is that they're going to go and score them on the black market. And what that's going to do is expose them to these unpredictable doses of fentanyl, which is probably why, in spite of all these efforts, the overdose rates are up 126%, while the opioids prescribed are down 60%. There's 43% of current U.S. medical clinics who refuse to see any new patients who will require opioids. The prescribers have gotten really scared. They're intimidated. And what's happening is, like I said, people are being forced onto rapid tapers, or they're just being taken off their medications or kicked out of practices leaving them high and dry with really no alternative. This study came out in August, and I've been sitting on it waiting to have a chance to talk about it, because to me, I read this and it was like, duh, it's a complex therapy. The question at the top of this article, published by the University of California Davis Health, is reducing opioids for pain patients linked to higher rates of overdose and mental health crisis? Well, yeah, this study was published in JAMA August 3rd, and patients who had been on stable opioid therapy, that means they'd been taking the same dose for a long time for chronic pain, who had their doses tapered, had statistically significant higher rates of overdose and mental health crisis. So this looked at 113,000 people who were requiring the equivalent of 50 milligrams of morphine per day for a year with stable dosing. And then it looked at emergency department visits or hospital admissions for any drug overdose, drug withdrawal, or mental health crisis, such as depression, suicidal ideation, or suicide attempt. And they found, would you be surprised, a 68% increase in overdose events and a doubling of mental health crises among the tapered. And the faster you tapered them, the higher the risk. Surprise, surprise. We're supposed to carefully monitor people while we're tapering them. How much careful monitoring have you had for your health in the last 18 months? Just saying. The system is strapped for personnel. Doctors and nurses are leaving the field in droves. And careful monitoring? Well, that's for the fortunate few. Most people haven't even seen their doctor for a year, particularly if they're in an HMO. They've seen a TV screen with their doctor on it, maybe. And I listened just recently on that topic to someone talking about how they missed the diagnosis on a patient who they had basically gone out to the car to try to evaluate the person, and they didn't find anything on exam. But you can't do a physical exam through a car window. Trust me on this. You can't do that. So our first email tonight comes from Lynn in San Juan Bautista. Hi there, Lynn. I was in your neighborhood today, and it's a beautiful countryside there. Probiotic to manage type 2 diabetes is the subject of Lynn's email. This weekend, I met a woman who started a business that uses probiotics to help manage blood sugar levels through the microbiome. She comes to this from a medical background. Pharmaceuticals, I think, and is sincerely excited about the results of her product in testing and its ability to help reduce blood sugar levels. She was very down to earth, and her product seemed aligned with your approach to health. So I thought I'd share, in case you have not heard of this effort. Perhaps there are several companies doing similar work. I don't know. Her company's called Pendulum Therapeutics. So, folks, I think it was last week or possibly the week before that I did a little aside about how to validate an internet site, what to look for a legitimate site. And I'm happy to say that although this was nice and slick and clearly professionally done, they actually had data, a published research in the BMJ Open Diabetes Research and Care, which is peer reviewed. I checked. So they're a legitimate journal. The study is actual science, and I'm going to give you some of the background here. You all know I'm very fond of my microbiome, and I like to think of myself as a gut gardener for all of the people who come and see me. And one of the known things about the microbiome is that if you have type 2 diabetes, there are certain abnormalities in your microbiome. Specifically, there are decreases in several bacteria. One of them is an anaerobic bug called Akkermansia mucinophilia, which has become a very, very big player in my world because this is an anti-inflammatory bacteria that actually exerts a calming effect on the immune system. And people who have low levels of it have more gut inflammation, therefore more leaky gut, more irritable bowel syndrome, and etc. Other microbes are also involved in producing butyrate and short chain fatty acids. These are extremely important components that are made by breaking down dietary fiber. So if you do not have the right bacteria, a lot of the dietary fiber that you eat will not be digested. It will go straight through you and it won't be used by anybody, including the large intestine cells that survive on these short chain fatty acids. So your ability to function, your gut's ability to absorb and process nutrition is actually severely compromised. Now, it has been noted that when you give people metformin, which is like the first line therapy for diabetes and prediabetes, and is also used by many doctors, I use it for 3 months to see if it helps with people who have obesity. One of the things that's observed apparently as a side effect or a side benefit is that you do see increases in the abundance of these butyrate producers and also in the Akkermansia mucinophilia. So that's great when you give metformin. But is that just a side effect of metformin, or is there an additional benefit by giving more bacteria? And that was the question that they asked in this study. And the study basically created a product, which is the Pendulum Therapeutics product, a combination, as I said, of inulin, Akkermansia, Bifidobacterium infantis, which you get in your mother's milk if you're lucky, and a couple of Clostridia species that are beneficial. And they gave these to several individuals. Let's see, 25 subjects per arm. So they had about 50 people, and they gave them placebo, or they gave them the active probiotics. All of these people were on metformin. And what they measured in the individuals over the 12 weeks of the study was they looked at how their body reacted to a carbohydrate load, and they looked at their hemoglobin A1C, hence the 12 weeks. And what they saw was a substantial improvement, a decrease in the A1C amounting to about a half a percentage point, which is a substantial decrease. When I see someone go from a 6.5 to a 6.0, I shoot off fireworks and congratulate them, because that's a major improvement in their glucose control. And particularly in people who are doing that with diet, that shows the power of making these changes. Often the diet we're talking about includes increasing the fiber, and increasing the fiber increases these bacteria, leads to more butyrate, and the world spins around and gets better. So this product looks good, is really what I'm saying. I'm not sure if any other companies are doing that. That would be a very hard thing to research. But I would say that this is legit. It's supported by data. And I do think that I will look into maybe offering this, or at least suggesting it to my patients. I'd like to take a look at what other products have that, but that's going to take more time than I had in preparing to respond to this email. Our second email comes from Diane in Mount Hood, Oregon. Diane writes, long-term use of antibiotics and microbiome. I listen to your podcast every week and I just love it. My 69-year-old male friend was diagnosed with vertebral osteomyelitis in March of 2021. Just for the audience, that translates to a bacterial infection in one of the vertebrae. So once you get a bacterial infection in bone, it's very hard to treat, because it's hard to get a high enough blood level. Continuing with Diane's email, he was put on oral antibiotics until culture results revealed the bacteria was E. coli. A PICC line was then inserted, and he received IV antibiotics in April, May, and June. Sounds like he got the standard 12-week course of IV antibiotics, after which he was switched back to oral. His condition continues to deteriorate, resulting in emaciation, losing 50 pounds. My question is whether this long-term use of antibiotics could be contributing to this malnutrition and loss of appetite. The most recent MRI shows that the infection remains active in his, probably his T12 disc. I think that's a typo. So, Diane, before I talk about your question, I just want to point out that any kind of chronic infection uses a lot of energy. The immune system in fighting an infection uses a lot of energy. It's been calculated, for example, that when someone is admitted to the hospital with a bad pneumonia or with bacterial sepsis, which is a severe infection, they may use up to 7,000 calories a day just lying still with an IV in their arm and often not getting fed. So rapid weight loss is bad for lots of reasons, but just be aware that that chronic disease his immune system is trying to fight with the help of the antibiotics is a large part of that weight loss. But that being said, as the previous email elucidated, gut bacteria are critical to butyrate, and it's critical to the production of vitamin K and other nutritional substances. So there may be drastic changes in your friend's ability to absorb nutrients. This is a very serious situation. You need to seek prompt evaluation from a functional medicine doctor or an FM nutritionist. That's very important, and I am hoping that you will be able to do so. You need organic acid testing and microbiome testing. I did do a little Google Scholar search, and I found one paper showing that prolonged antibiotic in mice who were sick caused weight loss, but in healthy military recruits, they actually resulted in weight gain. So go figure. We're going now to talk to John. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Hello. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Question for you. I have. I'm a power of attorney for a 90-year-old friend of mine, and some months ago, she was had to go into the hospital for COVID-19, and she recovered. She's doing well. And then, unexpected, I received a call from someone there asking me what her heart pacemaker was. And I was puzzled because I wasn't aware that she had had, and she hadn't told me about it. And the fact was she didn't have one, apparently. And I recommend, asked them to please let me know what it was. And then I had a doctor from the hospital contact me and wanted to have an operation for her to insert a pacemaker in her heart.
So, what's going on? Is that your question?
Correct. I know you're an observant doctor, and that being said, it was puzzling to me. And as a power of attorney for 90-year-old person with COVID in your hospital, I have no problems dealing with it. But at the same time, I need to know more details. And the previous call the day before was insisting that she had one and so forth. Now they were calling me, wanting to add one to it, which she did not have, apparently.
And yeah, I can understand your confusion. Okay, so first of all, if a person has a pacemaker, you can forget if it was like placed, 20 years ago, you might actually forget you had it. It's pretty obvious on physical exam and on looking at the patient because the pacemaker is actually palpable and you can feel it. It's the older ones in particular, about the size of a pack of cigarettes, and they're under the skin. So unless someone has marked amounts of fat in their skin and the pacemaker was placed deep, it's hard for me to imagine that you wouldn't pick it up on physical exam. The first phone call you got, I don't know for sure, but I think it was probably a delegated phone call. In other words, someone was given instructions to call, and maybe they misunderstood the instructions, and maybe the instructions were to call and let you know that they needed a pacemaker, but somehow
they actually asked me for the brand that she had.
I understand, but that would have been maybe they had three or four calls to make and they confused them because if it's a delegated thing, I mean, I think that's human error. Okay, that's what I'm saying. Maybe it was simply human error or lost in translation, a failure to communicate. Those things happen and obviously, they can lead to severe things. Putting a pacemaker in a 90-year-old person. Let me address that for a moment.
Who, by the way, has stage 4 uterine cancer?
Well, the big question is, how's her quality of life? Can she get up and walk across the room?
Absolutely.
Does she complain of dizziness and have to, you know, if she's standing, does she complain of dizziness and have to sit down?
Not at all.
All right. So what this suggests is that while on paper she may have a slow heartbeat and need a pacemaker, she's...
En contraire, mon frère, mon sœur.
Okay.
She does not have... Her heart is quite good.
Right.
And her doctors always say her heart is quite good.
Well, then she doesn't need a pacemaker. My point was that regardless of what the EKG shows, you see, maybe her EKG was weird. And they looked at the slow heart rate on her EKG and said, oh, my God, this woman needs a pacemaker without any clinical information. I'm just speculating. But that's one of the more likely things, in my opinion.
And my question, and a doctor called the following day, as I mentioned, and then said, oh, she needs a pacemaker. I said, okay, I have no problems. Let me speak to the surgeon and cardiologist. And this was back in February, and I'm still waiting for a call from them.
Yes. Now, I think it'll be a long wait, my friend. Mon frère.
Merci, merci.
Yes. Well, I don't want us to break into French, although I know we both could. But let's just, you know, not replay that excruciating moment from American Gigolo. But the thing is, the situation's gotten so incredibly chaotic. Everybody, like I was saying earlier, we're understaffed, we're overworked, we're trying to wrestle with this, you know, bizarre, half-buttocked dynamic of how to deliver care. And yeah, things have gone sideways in a major way. So hopefully the thing that I was taught, and it has served me very well, is step away from the lab test, step away from the EKG, look up and assess the patient. Are they fine? If they're fine and the labs say they're not fine, then repeat the labs because it's a lab error. If they're walking around and the EKG says they need a pacemaker, then get another EKG and get an ambulatory blood pressure because they're compensated. Whatever it is, they're used to it and they're fine. So look at the patient. Now, there are exceptions to that, but for the most part, the patient's going to tell you whether they need an intervention or not.
My thinking is for her, it appeared to be an unnecessary recommendation.
And
as a power of attorney, I had to step in and happy to deal with it. But at the same time, she's fine today, 8 months later. And sometimes I wonder, I've listened to you for years, and your logic is beyond normal medical doctors, and respect your thinking. But at the same time, it's just like, it made me think, why would they try to force me to agree for her to have a pacemaker installed in her?
Well, I don't know, but I'll tell you one thing, my friend. It wasn't because they were hurting for work. So they weren't trying to drum up business.
This was during the COVID period.
Yeah, they were sincere.
And she was in there for the COVID.
I understand. Listen, I think we're going in circles now, so thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
And
thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, so let's do something practical. Let's talk about demulcents and mucilages. That sounds rather interesting. We talked about Akkermansia muciphilia there a minute ago. And philia means love of. And Akkermansia, that bacteria that's good for the gut and anti-inflammatory, its favorite food is gastrointestinal mucus. So it's great, it's anti-inflammatory, but if you get really high levels of it because you take too much of that wonderful probiotic we were talking about, you might end up with a leaky gut because you've gotten rid of all of your protective mucus. Now, demulcent is a word that most of us aren't familiar with. When you hear mucilage, I at least think of these brown bottles of stuff that they used to give me in grade school to glue things together with. And it was this kind of yellow, thick honey kind of liquid. And it would dry to a sort of crystalline thing, kind of very similar to, I hope I don't gross you out here, but kind of very similar to when you get pink eye and it's the stuff that it glues your eyelashes together, sort of yellow crystalline stuff. Anyway, mucilage is an actual kind of chemical made up of a compound, a polysaccharide, in other words, a long sugar chain. It's very slimy and gummy if it comes in contact with water. And this slime and gumminess really helps soothe and reduce irritation by direct contact. In fact, the word demulcent is derived from the Latin term for caress. It's a soothing film. Often we call it a mucoprotective agent. They can come in several different forms, but they have some really positive properties for the gastrointestinal tract. They reduce irritation down the entire length, from basically the mouth to the anus, but they also get into the respiratory system and the bladder. Mucilages and demulcents can help people with irritable bladder, which is something we talked about recently on one of our most recent shows. They also help with irritation, such as muscle spasms, colic. They help protect against gastric acid. And there's a lot of wonderful herbal demulcents, which you can score at your local health food store. Some of them are herbs, licorice or licorice root or anise root, very effective, flaxseed, horehound, comfrey, marshmallow, which is a small little flower, and mullein are some of the more important ones. You may have heard of horehound cough drops. You can still buy those. They work as cough suppressants. They reduce irritation. You know, that little dry cough when you lie down, it responds very well to those. You have to know your herbalism to know whether you're going to be doing slippery elm, where it's the inner bark, or marshmallow, where it's the roots of the bush, or in the case of horehound, it's the leaves. Nattokinase, which is a compound that is used to create natto, which is a sort of protein compound that's used in Japanese cuisine a lot, produces a lot of mucilage, and it's very effective in soothing the gut. So kelp, seaweed, is another one. Okra, very mucilaginous if you've ever eaten okra. Plantain, which grows like a weed in my yard. Aloe vera. And many forms of cactus are also very effective. Science supports the use of these compounds, and we're coming up on cold and flu season, so I thought I'd share with you that there's studies looking at a combination of licorice, slippery elm, and marshmallow in a placebo trial, and you got a rapid relief of sore throat pain in people with pharyngitis. Another study looked at the symptom score for cough in the common cold and showed increased formation of mucus and alleviation of cough. There's also was a recent double-blind study, 60 people, reasonable number, and they compared licorice root with Pepto-Bismol in the eradication of H. pylori. So basically, one group got licorice, amoxicillin, metronidazole, and omeprazole, so standard triple therapy plus the licorice. The second group got Pepto-Bismol or bismuth subsalicylate, amoxicillin, metronidazole, and omeprazole. So then they compared which group got better faster, and it turned out that the licorice worked better than the Pepto-Bismol, which is useful information. Now, too much licorice can raise your blood pressure, so it's important that people with high blood pressure be careful with their dosing or use DGL, which is a form of licorice deglycerated, which means the glyceratic acid has been removed. And in that case, it doesn't have an effect on blood pressure. I use that all the time for reflux and dyspepsia. In other words, you know, acid reflux or pain. And it also works very well for the control of ulcer pain. So we're leaving on the table some very useful herbal compounds, given that it's harder and harder to get dextromethorphan because that's suddenly gotten flagged as an opiate in many pharmacies. Yeah, so ties it back to our original story. But anyway, these agents are really effective. Let's take the last 5 minutes and talk about one of those things that that algorithm was looking at, and that's the impact of childhood trauma and stressors on pain disorders. People who have severe childhood trauma or PTSD often appear to have more pain. And the question is this a psychological effect or is something happening to the system during childhood? Statistically, we see that childhood trauma is a predisposing factor in the development of fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, insomnia, anxiety, PTSD, and chronic fatigue. But it's not all psychological. It's epigenetic. Childhood trauma causes cumulative damage and changes the way the body works and also changes the way the brain wires. The central nervous system and related hormone systems are rapidly developing during childhood, and the recurrent experiences teach the brain the thresholds for response. The sympathetic adrenal medullary system, this is part of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and they're the main players in the stress response system. These are neurological circuits which exist, they develop, but they're trained for their thresholds by events. So they're triggered when a stressor occurs to produce an appropriate stress response. You get adrenaline and you get cortisol being released. They mobilize energy stores, they alter blood flow, they activate the immune system, and they enhance your short-term memory so that you remember the thing that caused the stressor. And the development of a healthy stress response is vital for long-term health. And it's conditioned, and I want parents to listen carefully, by regular exposure to moderate but short-lived stressors, such as overcoming basic fears, brief exposures to pathogens, and minor physical injuries. Even traumatic stimuli, if they are short-lived and experienced in a supportive context, actually encourage positive neuroplasticity. If you don't allow that child to encounter and develop an appropriate proportional response to pain, injury, and fear, they will not develop an appropriate adult response. Stressful experiences need to be balanced with adequate pleasurable experiences, such as physical affection and security. Hug the child and kiss it better, in other words. When you have strong, frequent, or prolonged stressful stimuli in childhood, you get sustained activation of these hormonal stress responses, and they're trained in to be hyperreactive. It leads to hyperarousal and dysregulation of these systems. You get prolonged cortisol, which suppresses the immune system, and you also get an altered neurotransmitter imbalance, which affects pain perception. So these individuals are going to have elevated cortisol for their life, which is going to influence the glucocorticoid receptor gene. It's going to increase their risk for multiple sclerosis. It's going to create a hypervigilance, anxiety, irritable bowel syndrome, and fibromyalgia. It's going to make them emerge just by basis of resetting the system into a way that predisposes it. But in the presence of a strong support system and normal short-lived stressors, children do well. The positive pathways are developed, and the nervous system learns how to appropriately respond to stressors of life. We need to build healthy resilience into our children, and we need to recognize that people who may not have had the opportunity to build that healthy resilience are going to require special consideration during their life. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.